This is Bucky Stanton, and welcome to Technology Storytellers, brought to you by the Society for the History of Technology. On this episode, I speak with Dr. Charlton McIlwain, professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University, and author of the 2019 book, Black Software, The Internet, and Racial Justice, From the Afronet to Black Lives Matter. He's also author of Race Appeal, How Candidates Invoke Race in U.S. Political Campaigns, and Death in Black and White, Death, Ritual, and Family Ecology. McIlwain discusses the relationship between technological innovation and oppression, alternative black technological trajectories and their subsequent closure, the politics of computing infrastructure, and reflects on finding reasons for hope. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Absolutely. Great to be here.
So just to start us off, we'll be talking about your new book, Black Software, today. And I just wanted to ask you to kind of lay out an overarching history. What do you see as the patterns historically that you cover in the book of racial and technical formation? How do they work together? And what's the important kind of narrative here?
Yeah, thanks. As you know from the book is laid out as two stories, really, and that covers the range of the narrative. And those two stories are this. On the one hand, what is America's technology infrastructure? What is its relationship to Blackness and Black people? And then what is Black people's relationship to technology in a technical sense, in a social, you know, economic, political sense? And so really about a relationship and an arc of a relationship that's been built over the last 60, 70 years. And so really what that comes down to for me is sort of a story about, on the one hand, Black people who gained access to technology, and so recognizing, uncovering, identifying people who have not been a part of the historical landscape when we think about technology, when we think about the internet. So who are these people? When, how, where did they access these technical tools, and what did they do with them? And so one story is really about the ingenuity, the creativity, the technical prowess of Black people who took technology, used it for their purposes to enrich their own individual lives, the lives of Black communities, and really, in no uncertain terms, built the internet and much of the features of the internet as we know it today. So that's one story, which is a kind of a hidden figure story about people that we have never really known about, people we've never sort of acknowledged in this sort of history of technology, history of the internet. And then the flip story is really when we look over a longer arc of history and think about the development of computing technology in particular, which grows up and begins to sort of develop right around the same time as the zenith of the civil rights movement in the 1960s. How does that constellation really in that decade kind of set the stage and the foundation for our technological future? That is, how our computing technology from the 1960s up to our present work to both facilitate opportunity for Black people, but more importantly, how it sort of works to destroy in many ways Black people, Black interests.
And could you just, in this overarching mode, could you connect kind of that history that you just laid out to any earlier periods of history in Black cultures and communities? Because to me, it's a fascinating resonance, and this is a little off the cuff, so no worries. Sure. If you don't have a prepared answer here. But for me, it's such an interesting change from the rural agrarian connotation of slavery, which obviously, like most Black people in America, were brought here through. And then the change we see coming into the 20th century, the change into an industrial commercial invention by Black inventors, and then a shift to a entertainment media technology invention. And this was actually a theme me and Rayvon Fouché, one of my guests from a couple episodes ago, covered. So do you have any connections between what you just laid out, that really interesting dialectic, and kind of the farther history of Black people in America and invention?
Yeah, it's very interesting, and you know, I was very inspired by Raybon's work early on and research, and there's a lot of connection here because, in the one hand, you are talking about kind of the same story about Black invention on the one hand, and then the sort of wider racial formation, political, cultural context that either sort of facilitates in some ways and at some periods of time, or denies the ability for Black invention to really be harnessed, known, proliferate in ways that really benefit Black people. And so I think what you see is a very persistent pattern. And it's interesting, you know, folks like A. Philip Randolph, and other civil rights labor movement pioneers that I talk about in the book that were very much part of this question around technology with the advent of computing. But what they knew was less about computing and more about prior histories of technological invention with respect to Black people and the Black labor force. And what they readily acknowledged was this pattern, which is we have technology, that technology gets used in the service of maintaining a particular power relationship, a particular supremacy of whiteness and white interests to be able to harness, enslave, control Black people. And so that is the sort of status quo about how technology gets used. Then you have the sort of cat and mouse, which is that Black folks gain access to those very same technologies in some way to use it for their own interests, be those social, economic, or otherwise. And then in a sense, the system catches up to itself, or a kind of correction that is made. And so that the next technology or the next tool comes in to, you know, in a sense, correct. And so what, you know, what Randolph and others sort of recognized when they were looking forward to what was coming with computing, with automation, with a new labor force, they were looking at the future and seeing a past where here we're starting to do a whole different way of working, of making money, of engineering and economy. But we've prepared Black people for the last thing, not the new thing. And so as we are saying, we're going to keep and get Black people up to speed so they can participate in the workforce and do so meaningfully. And this is happening, you know, throughout Reconstruction and, you know, up through you know, the long civil rights movement, as we're talking about it, and people are starting to think about how do we engineer greater opportunities. So at the same time, we're trying to open up the workforce and allowing Black folks to gain skills and access to the tools that they knew that they need to be part of that labor force. We're doing that at the same time that we're planning for the future, but denying access to the technology of the future. And so that Black people will always remain one step behind, as it were. And that somewhere that course correction, when we get back to this idea about invention, that course correction is always, you get to a point where you're successful, but successful to the point, and that success has a limit, and at certain point the infrastructure forecloses on the ability for Black inventors, Black entrepreneurs to really capitalize on their invention. And that's very much a part of the Black software story. But again, it's that it's two parts, you know, two sides of the same coin, if you want to put it that way. So we see in the late 70s, a kind of movement and unfolding of Black technology use, invention, et cetera, that magnifies itself and showcases itself most prominently with the advent of the web in the early 90s, and some key folks and companies like Afrolink and Net Noir and many others. And so that is then the sort of fulfillment, the showcase. But what happens is, you know, by the end of the 2000s, all of that that happens in the course of that time period is gone. And much of what Black Software was about was trying to then say, all right, here's a story about Black invention and Black ingenuity and Black technology use for both individual, social, communal uses that then precipitously disappears, falls off a cliff, and what accounts for that? There's got to be a reason why this happened. There's got to be a reason why all of these folks that were so engaged in building content, producing content, building infrastructures, building for-profit, nonprofit ventures that work, that were prominent. There's a reason why that all disappears and goes away. And then that links back to this longer overarching history about the struggle of technology and its relationship to Blackness and Black people that I start in the book in the 1960s, but it's a longer history that plays out with the newest and latest technology.
Wow, what a fascinating answer. Thanks so much for off the cuff laying that out. Sure. Did not prepare, did not warn you about that, but
it's okay. And I should interrupt just to say that, Simone Brown's work, I don't know if she's been part of your show, but, she is, when I think about Rayvon and Simone, those are two key kind of parts of that story that I'm telling. And I sort of kind of take for granted that that is there and their work is there. And I pick up sort of in the 1960s, but their work picks up largely before that. But it's the same story in many ways.
Can you remind us of what Simone's book is? I'm forgetting the name.
Yeah, I am too, right now, as it turns out. Simone's book is, having one of those
I got
moments.
I got it.
You got it?
Dark Matters.
Dark Matters.
Yeah.
How could I forget? So Dark Matters, it's the book. It's one of those that I read, probably two or three times as I was really starting Black Software. And it gave me a sense because there was, there's a moment when I'm writing. I'm not a historian, right? I'm a social scientist generally by training. And, most of the work and career is in that vein. And so when I started off writing this book, I hit a wall at a moment, sort of in two ways. Number one, I started off thinking, I want to write a book that accounts for Black Lives Matter and its rise to prominence, where that came from, and particularly the digital underpinnings of that movement. And very quickly, I started seeing this sort of larger historical arc as I go back to the 90s, the 80s, the 70s, and find all of these Black folks that I had never known, I think most people had never known and seen, who were building and doing all this cool stuff. And then, there was a moment where I said, I know where this is going. Like, I know if I open myself up, if I've looked and now found folks that I never thought I would find in the 90s and then in the 80s and then in the 70s, if I let myself go back another 10 years, my guess is there's a story there and probably quite an interesting and complicated one. And for me, that was a sort of scary moment because I'm like, I got to write a book and I have a timeline. And I've told these folks what this book was going to be about, and it's already starting to unravel into something else. And so part of me is like, holy shit, I don't know if I want to go there. But part of what gave me sort of the comfort that I could and should, and that I could do so without sort of feeling the need to go all the way back, was Simone's work, because it really takes you through that longer history from slavery and even up through and past the 60s, but that kind of prehistory of Here's technology, here's black people, here's the cycle that plays out over and over and over again. And it allows me to say, all right, here's a very specific story then when we get to the 60s and the technology is computing technology. And how does that then in a very specific way start to lay the infrastructure for the kind of massive surveillance state that we have that exists, that's ubiquitous around us today.
And bringing up Simone's book's really interesting, Dark Matters, because it reminds us that after the end of slavery, black people entered a new role as workers, but also were in a differently racialized perspective. And oftentimes the cycles of capitalism that worked upon workers and consolidate capital and forces, like you were talking about earlier, happened to black people earlier. They happened to them more rigorously. And then those technologies and systems are brought back later. So that's just such a fascinating kind of thing you lay out. Thank you so much. And so could you kind of bring us into some of these stories that you use in the book to talk about all this, some of your, you know, favorite through lines, your favorite kind of pieces of black technologists working with technologies, and try and lay it out in a way that explains why these things didn't exist anymore by the early 2000s.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I'll do it this way. There are two kind of key stories that I'll try to kind of walk through and make this connection. And I'm going to do it, you know, the book is sort of backwards because I start with the sort of the 90s up to the present, then go back to the sort of the beginning and start in the 60s and come through. But I'll start with the foundation in the 60s, and this is really connecting to that larger infrastructure around technology, the US, and sort of the maintenance of that existing racial order. And so it's a very kind of a simple dynamic and fascinating set of stories that that crystallize it. So I'll start with IBM, right? The 1960s computing industry. IBM is really it, right? They're building these technologies. They are ubiquitous in a lot of ways, both in and beyond the United States. And so Tom Watson Jr., Tom Watson, the founder of IBM, they have a very specific framing of the company. IBM exists to solve problems. That's their basic mission, right? So we solve problems, doesn't matter what area it is. We have a way to solve it. We have a technological computing solution to help you solve your problem, right? And, you know, it's fascinating the ways in which IBM, as much as it was a computing company, a technology company, was very much a marketing company who spent a lot of time, capital, et cetera, on marketing. And so one of the features of their marketing was just this. They would send out their salespeople to folks, and it might be in the banking industry, might be in a sort of a transportation industry. And they would say, what's your problem? And it wasn't like we have a thing and we want you to sell, you know, we want you to buy this one thing that we have and then figure out what you could do with it. It was, we have this stuff, but I want to know your problem. And then I can make this stuff work for you and then give something to you that will help you solve your problem. And so this was, you know, where IBM was in the early mid 60s. And I'm remembering back to one of my kind of favorite stories of the book where, you know, it's basically this IBM salesman who, you know, walks in fairly nonchalantly into an FBI meeting room to meet with some folks in the sort of law enforcement arena in the federal government. And, you know, you can understand perfectly that this is a revolving door, had no problem gaining entry. And, you know, and basically his story was, hey, look, you know, you're the federal government. I know you have an interest in law enforcement. We've got a lot of new tools we're rolling out that allow you to do this and do that. So, you know, what do you need? What can we do for you? How can we help? And then that relationship then kind of spawns many things. So IBM early 1964, computer solved problems. The next question, of course, is when we're thinking nationally, so what is the problem? What is the national problem that we need to solve? And someone had an answer to that question. And the answer came from the president, Lyndon Johnson, 1964. Part of this was his doing. Part of this was his trying to be responsive to his constituency. And so white America is coming to him and saying, we have a massive problem with crime. And incidentally enough, Lyndon Johnson was sort of like, not really. Like, this is no big deal. But people are saying, no, this is an issue, this is an issue. And the reality was that there was a conflation being made, of course, right? So people, black people, were in the streets of America seemingly every day protesting, fighting for their rights. That's what people were seeing on the television more and more. That's what they were seeing when they were walking around the streets. This is who they were afraid of. And so crime became the name that they gave to this problem of black people and black violence, and what they feared was coming. And so Johnson relented and sort of said, all right, so we've got this massive problem, how do we solve it? And so he called into the being a presidential crime commission. And the mission of that commission was, or the charge was, tell us why people commit crimes. So what are the causes of crimes? What's the impact? How do we solve it? How do we make sure that it doesn't happen again? Right? So very open-ended, but what was very clear as Johnson articulated the mission of the commission was that crime was very much racialized. It was black, it was urban, it was poor, right? That's your visible, explicit face of the crime problem. Now, the next layer then is, on the one hand, you've got Johnson with a national problem that he's called to solve about crime. On the other hand, you've got IBM, who's looking for problems and has a technical solution. Johnson acknowledges this, and so he forms within that commission a special science and technology task force. The charge for that task force is, we've used computing in other areas successfully, namely the defense industry. What can computing technology do to help us solve this crime problem? And that was a very specific charge. And so this task force, which included folks from leading science and technology institutions like MIT and others, it included a lot of folks from IBM, both technical folks and marketing sales folks, interestingly enough, and folks that were in science and engineering capacities at varying places in the federal government, generally in the sort of the defense industry element. And so these were the people on the task force. Long story short, in short order, they completed their mission. And what resulted came to fruition in 1968, several years following. It got started very early after the task force, but really came into fruition with a system that was called Alert 2 in Kansas City, Missouri. This was what began to be called a criminal justice information system. And it was built by, in consultation with folks at the Kansas City Police Department, folks from IBM, and with sort of prior backing from that task force and a number of experiments and studies that had come out of it. So what was Alert 2? Alert 2 was first a benign crime database. We simply want a tool to keep track of people that we arrest, their you know, interactions with the court or criminal justice system, whatever it happens to be, or the juvenile justice system, whatever it happens to be. So at first it was just a database. Then it grew into a communication system. And so it was a way to deploy police across the city. Then it became much more of a crime database. The database turned into functionality to provide crime analysis, then prediction, then profiling and targeting, and all of these things. And so Alert 2 was a technological system that allowed the Kansas City Police Department to be networked with other police departments, as well as the federal government, the FBI crime database. And they could essentially take the map of the city, deploy police based on varying targets that always mapped onto race. And in essence, what you get with Alert 2 and what proliferates into a massive growth of these criminal justice information systems all across the country is the surveillance infrastructure that we have in place now that has all of those features of profiling, targeting, et cetera. So all of that came out of a first question, which is we have a tool, we have a problem. That tool gets used in the service of that problem. And in this particular case, it happened to be that that problem was a group of people, Black people. And the technology then in its first instance goes to control, keep in place, to work negatively to criminalize Black people, Black communities, and then we sort of know that story going forward. And so the point of that story itself is really to say, in its very first instances, computing was used in this way. It was conceived of in this way as something not to give voice to open up opportunity. One could very much see a different course of action, right? You've got the civil rights movement going at the same time. You have landmark voting rights legislation being signed. One could have said we could make our new computing technology serve those interests and gains that we were making, but they did not, right? They did something that was quite to the contrary. So that's one story. The second I pick up with a guy named William Morrell, who was someone I ran into early in the course of writing the book and was really one of those people whose story changed the course of Black software. Number one, he was the first person who I ever saw use the term Black software. And so that's where the title comes from. But as I started interviewing folks early on, I would ask the same question of most of them, which was, you know, who are you? When did you first get online? When were you first on the internet? And I was pretty sure I knew the answer to that question, right? So it's really just kind of a starter. When I got on the phone and I was talking to William that first time, I asked that question and he kind of paused and was like, let me think. I'd say 1978. And I was like, what? What is this man saying to me? How can I conceive of? And so I asked him the question, you got to tell me what that means. What does it mean that you're online, that you're on the internet in 1978? And so then he begins to lay out this story that is sort of a different trajectory, right? So in the 1960s, much of what is able to happen because Black people in the main were not part of the technology infrastructure. They weren't hanging out at MIT because they weren't letting people like that into MIT. They had no kind of say within government. They were not, part of the employee infrastructure at technology companies like IBM, right? So no access really to the technology, no access to determining what the course of this technology would be, what it would look like now and in the future. So that begins to change as you get through the late 60s, early 70s. Ironically, IBM is part of that kind of changing landscape. So somewhere, early 70s, William goes, he graduates high school, and he really wants to become a roadie with the band. He loves music. And so he thinks, you know, music engineering, maybe that's something I want to do. He goes to DeVry Technical Institute in Georgia, two-year tech school, gets an associate's degree, comes back to North Carolina, does a couple of jobs in varying sort of industries, and then ends up working at IBM. And his story about first being online comes from the late 70s, early 80s, when IBM had built essentially an internet that was, it was closed for IBM, but William was working a job as essentially tech support. And so what they would do is go out to businesses that were using IBM machines. And if they needed to connect to the company or someone higher up to be able to solve a problem, there was an internet where they could connect and do that. So there was an internet infrastructure that was closed that was for the company. And similar that similar technology they had put to use in places like the White House and other kind of closed organizations at the time. So William does that. He starts to hate working at IBM, but he learns it all. And he starts to think, like, look, I hate working at this place. There are no people like me. And the people are stuck up, I think is the word that he used. And but he recognized, here is something that's valuable to me. So I'm going to learn it. I'm going to take it. And then when he got his opportunity, he took off. He left the company, decided to move to Boston. And long story short, he ends up in sort of Black Boston neighborhood in Roxbury. Some very interesting dynamics that ultimately leave him at owning a new computer store. And he opens a computer store in Cambridge. It's the only Black-owned computer store in the area, certainly in Cambridge, but also in Boston. He turns it into a multi-million dollar business. At a later point, gets connected to the AfroNet, which is an early bulletin board service that was Black-owned, controlled, policed, etc. That translated into him being involved in CompuServe, who wanted to basically replicate AfroNet, the AfroNet community, in this new commercial public web space. Wasn't successful. But here is someone then whose relationship to technology came in a very different way in terms of his access through IBM. Did go to college, two-year tech degree, learns the tools, learns how to master them, and then ends up in a way that he's able to succeed as an entrepreneur, selling technology, but also building what he started to call Black software, which is a whole other story of where that came from. But those are kind of two stories that I kind of key in that sort of, I think, illustrate what I'm talking about. And then the fact that the Williams of the world, and there were others who were much more commercially successful when we think about Net Noir and Malcolm Cassell and David Ellington and others. And then, you know, as I said, by the end of the 2000s, all of that stuff that they were building, involved in, et cetera, disappears, goes away. And that's when then that sort of prehistory kind of kicks in. And my explanation at the end of the book, which I sort of leave more with the question than the answer, but it is kind of, I think it says something like, will we ever outrun our history? And that is that kind of, there is a history that very much shapes the limits, the boundaries of Black technology today. And then the question is, can we ever get ourselves out of that status quo, that structure? And if so, what will it take?
Well, I think to close this out here, answer your own question. What's your take on that? Because that last chapter, chapter 17, I found very inspiring because it attempts to very succinctly grapple with this incredibly complex, contradictory, sometimes triumphant, sometimes deeply disturbing and sad because of just the continued pattern over time we keep talking about of authority on Black people, even making these technological strides. So what's your answer to your own question? How do we grapple with that? And how, you know, how is it a little bit more complicated than just getting Black kids in STEM?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a big question. I think part of the reason why I left without answering it in the book. But in large ways, it is that it still lingers, I think, as a question, not just for me, but for all of us, right? And so it, you know, it's complicated in that I think we have to wrestle with this very clear dynamic, right? When we look at the landscape of the internet today and Black technologists, we don't see what we saw for a very brief moment in the early 90s, which is a very large group of visible Black folks who were in positions of both building, producing, capitalizing, benefiting from the content and technology that they were building. And we look today, you see, you know, a handful, right? If at all, and those are not what we would see as very large and profitable entities, even that still do exist, right? So we have to grapple with how do we explain, you know, what was for, you know, folks like Bill Clinton and Al Gore supposed to be this big burgeoning information superhighway that was going to usher in democratic opportunity, particularly for Black folks and other marginalized groups. And how do we account for the fact that all of those free, open tools and access has still landed Black folks back in the same place, which is not able to control access and control their own destiny vis-a-vis technology, technological use and invention. And so I think it's because of the story that I tell in book two in the book about this larger history that, you know, I have to admit that I end the book for me very kind of pessimistically, because the complexity of a technological infrastructure that's been in place for so long and that was built in its first instance to thwart all of these things about, or these ways that might benefit Black people, it seems so entrenched and difficult to find our way out of, right? So that's kind of where I leave off, and I leave the book. And, you know, I remember when I was doing my first book talk, which I did at the Oxford University Press offices to their team of folks. And I sort of ended there and kind of telling the story, and somebody was sort of like, you can't sell books being that pessimistic. You know, that was the gist. And I thought, yeah, I know, but it's real. So I think for me, you know, it becomes about, it doesn't become about an answer out there. I don't think we can find an answer that says, here's a silver bullet. If we just do this, this, and this, we will get there. I think we are bound to a consistent and constant relationship that is about struggle, right? And I remember doing a book talk at the Strand, and my colleague, Dr. Ruha Benjamin at Princeton was gracious enough to be in conversation with me on that. And she sort of ended with this same question. And I sort of had to admit to her that, you know, I'm deeply pessimistic about the future. I'm deeply pessimistic about the prospect of Black folks gaining a foothold and grasp on technology in a way that would serve our interests in a radically different way than it has historically. And so we we asked ourselves sort of that question. I sort of turned to her and asked, you know, you tell me, you know, and she had written a great book, Race After Technology, which really brings us kind of forward to look at the current juxtaposition of race and AI and these massive surveillance and algorithmically driven systems and how they work against Black people. And she, you know, she sort of said, like, I find comfort and energy in the work of Black technologists and Black activists and folks, young people across the country who are struggling to do something different, right? And I think when I come around to it, that's where I end up. I don't see an answer, right? And the answer to even get us at a starting point is complicated and manifold. You know, we've got to train, educate folks, not just for the technology landscape, right? And, you know, as much as people say, we've got to learn and teach everybody to code and do all these kinds of things. You know, yeah, maybe, but we've got to educate Black folks in particular and other marginalized folks to be able to do whatever it is that they want with their lives and see that as a viable solution. And then that empowers them to do many of these other things. But I think the solution, if there is one, or I should say the optimism, if there is optimism, there is in all of our collective, but mostly young folks, struggle to do something different. Whether those are entrepreneurs in tech who are fighting to gain voice and gain and get access to networks of capital to generate and put forward their ideas, which many are doing and doing very well at, and really kind of drawing attention to the need for more capital investment in Black technology ideas, to excuse me, folks that are working at places like, you know, Facebook and Google and so forth, and saying, you know, I'm here, I'm making money, but I see the tools that I'm building and the ways that they work against the communities that I care about, and want to change that in some way, either from inside of those companies or externally, right? And so the point I'm making is that I think what we see on the current landscape are people connected to this sort of technological infrastructure and still saying there are sites of struggle that are important and where we can make change. And so I think our answer comes in not just trying to do the quick and easy, you know, let's get some more Black people in tech. You know, we need that. I have a lot of ideas about how we could and should be doing that. But I think it's a struggle from all sides to say, look, here's technology that does not work for us. Here's how it works against us. Here's our struggle to make that different, as well as to provide a way for us to build new kinds of technologies that do work for us, right? And that is really, you know, ending on the title of the book again about Black software, which is really about, in one instance, the ways, the sort of dark ways in which America's tech infrastructure has been created and used against Black people, and on the other side, the ways that Black people have taken and used that technology and marshaled it to do things that are in our own best interests.
I don't think that's a pessimistic answer at all. You know, I think that you're also leaving out that there's the amazing work of your own book, of Ruha's book, of Rayvon, of Simone, of other Black authors. And, you know, all these books, I think, have this really interesting combination too, that they're not like so driven into our literatures that they're unapproachable. They have these kind of almost popular facing elements. And that's I think a great example of what you're saying of Black people working within what power they have in agency to expand that message, be complicated and look at this as a process. So, you know, thanks so much for that answer. And if you have any more words on that, please feel free, but just.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, thanks. And I will, you know, sort of taking that cue. I do think it's one of the great things about our current moment. You know, when I first started looking at this kind of terrain about race and technology 8-10 years ago, I mean, there was, you know, it wouldn't be accurate to say there was nothing, but relatively not a lot. And so to look around today and see all of the colleagues that you mentioned and their work, of both people who have been doing this work for a long time and people who are early career folks that are doing this research and work. And I think the dynamic that makes this so powerful is that many of us are scholars, but many of us are parts of other careers, right? Our technologists have come from, you know, marketing backgrounds, education backgrounds. And the reason I bring that up is that, you know, we are scholars, but we are in our own way activists because we see the problems that were created, exacerbated by, that facilitate many of these aspects in terms of technology and Blackness and Black people. And our work, our writing, our doing things like, you know, what we're doing here today is what we see as part of our work to help make that that change. But it's great to look around and see, you know, mine is not the only voice, and someone can pick up my work and Sophia Noble's work and Simone Brown's work and see some complementary things that make it powerful to see that here's the same story, here's the same argument, here's the same rigorous work that's showing us the same kind of picture, but that broadens the landscape out basically in terms of our position and where we enter into to this work. And so it's fascinating to be in a moment when the ideas and thinking and the attention about racism, racialization, and technology are on the forefront of people's minds, both in the scholarly community, but also in the broader public.
Wow. You know, not as pessimistic as you think. I feel quite hopeful. You know, that's easy for me to say from as a white person, but from an intersectional approach and looking at how all this is overlapping with other social problems and other social groups, I hope we look back and historicize this moment later in your career, hopefully, as some significant period. And I just want to thank you so much, Charlton, for coming on today to Technology Storytellers and really engaging in the complexity of your story and also the present aspect of it and how important it is.
Thank you. It's been great to be here. And, you know, I'll close out again by sort of saying thanks to you for having me. And then also just to another kind of shout out to all of my colleagues and folks that want to find folks doing this work at criticalracedigitalstudies.com, the Center for Critical Race and Digital Studies. Lots of people doing really, really great work in this area. So check them out, read their stuff. There's a lot out there.